Tens of dollars in loss.
Committee on Environment and Natural Resources will come to order. First of all, welcome back to all the members, staff, and the stakeholders. We hope that 2009 is a productive year for the environment. And I want to thank everybody's work up until now for the tremendous work they've done, not only in this committee during session, but all the hard work that goes on during the interim on behalf of the environment. I don't think the public recognizes well enough how much work goes on between legislative sessions on the environment. In fact, it's perhaps one of the most active areas, not only in informal environmental work, but formal environmental work. Many of the members of this committee are members of working groups, commissions. Now there's an additional commission. This all takes away from the regular lives that a citizen legislator is supposed to have. And we need to recognize that a lot of the work that is done on the environment is not even done during legislative session, but in fact in preparation for it. So everyone here who has been on working groups, tours, commissions, we want to thank you for the work that you do that is uncompensated. And we'll seek to respect everyone's hard work when they present their whatever issue they do during this legislative session. We cannot start a meeting of this committee without recognizing the importance of the passage of the dedicated funding amendment this fall. Even though it was a funding amendment and much of the issues surrounding the dedicated funding amendment will go through finance committees, it's important to recognize that the amendment that was placed on the ballot was started in 2007 in this committee. It was those 4 days of hearings that truly shaped the most recent discussion of the amendment that passed in November. And it was the members of this committee that worked so hard in its crafting and presentation to voters. We also have to recognize the importance of your work on this committee on the establishment of the Lasard Outdoor Heritage Council, which is a new and unique model for the rest of the country in allocating environmental resources, habitat resources in this case. That work was crafted, passed, developed in this committee, and so we cannot go without recognizing your work on that as well. Most of the amendment discussion will happen in the context of our finance committees in the legislative process, but there will be impacts on policy, and this committee will be active just as much as any other committee in monitoring how the policies that we have in our state impact the dedicated funding dollars. Want to make sure that we know that the new amendment that was passed is just as much a function of policy as it is dollar signs. With that, members, I just want to take a brief moment to introduce new members of our committee. Senator Ken Kielash and Senator Lisa Phoebe. Senator Phoebe, why don't you introduce yourself and give us a little bit about your background, starting with the area that you represent.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Lisa Phoebe, and I represent District 16, which includes Big Lake, Becker, Elk River, all the way up to Lake Mille Lacs, almost over to Cambridge, and a little part of St. Cloud on the west side. So quite a big area, a little outstate. And my path to politics was somewhat through education. I served on the Princeton School Board for 8 years and also on the Minnesota School Board Association. So I'm really honored to be here and serving on this committee. Thank you.
Welcome. Senator Kielash.
Yes, I'm Senator Kielash. I represent District 63, Richfield, South Minneapolis, and Northern Bloomington. So my path is through the Carpenters Union and being active in politics for a long time within the DFL party. And a special election this summer got me here. So I'm looking forward to the committee work.
Thank you. Also want to also identify the committee staff. To my left, the legislative assistant, Mary Bibas, our committee clerk, Sumbul Mahmood, my committee administrator, Marianne Hecht, our committee staff, Senate counsel, Carla Doyle, Senate research, Greg Knopf, and also Republican staff, Mr. Werner, and Gloria Gunville is DFL staff, but she's not here at the moment. So all of these staff people remain a resource and are all do excellent work for our committee. Also want to give maybe a minute or two to members if they would like to discuss any particular committee priorities for this session. This is kind of an opportunity if you like to flag certain issues that you'd like the committee to address. You may do that now or in private, but whatever discussion committee members would like to have at this time, we're welcome to do that. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to mention what you already talked about, the constitutional amendment, the legacy funding, and the fact that it will be under the jurisdiction of this committee along with the Finance Committee, which I chair. And so this is one of our biggest challenges of the session and future years, to figure out how to use that money wisely and figure out what the best process for overseeing the money and making sure that we have long-term goals set that are accountable, transparent, and measurable to the public. So that's something that I'll be working on along with Senator Chaudhry, and just want to invite all of your participation and interest in putting that together, because I just think we have such a huge responsibility to the public with that vote that was so powerful across our state, that we got to make sure we show that we're using this money wisely and we're going to do it carefully and thoughtfully. So stay tuned.
Thank you. Other members? Seeing none, we can move. That is a good segue to our next our agenda items for today. Of course, a huge part of the new constitutional amendment was the establishment of a large pot of money in a new clean water fund. What should we do with that clean water money? What policies should we have in place that establish guidelines, or what policies need to be recognized more? And so that is a critical discussion that we need to have here. And what is the state's policy towards clean water? So we want to have a discussion about that, and want to begin with a presentation from the Freshwater Society about clean water. And I'd like to approach the table and introduce yourselves for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Gene Merriam, and I'm the president of the Freshwater Society. I have with me, let me introduce two individuals from the Freshwater Society, at least one of whom I know will be familiar to most of you. Pat Sweeney, who has been with the, I should say, first of all, I've been president of the Freshwater Society in a part-time capacity for almost a year and a half now. Pat Sweeney has been with us for a little over a year, and following a career as a journalist with the Pioneer Press, some of that time, or a good share of that time, covering events at the Capitol in the area of finance, and as well as others. And we also have with us Sherry Wagner sitting over here from the Freshwater Society. Let me just make a couple of brief comments about the Freshwater Society and then get into the report that we're prepared to talk to you about. The Freshwater Society is a nonprofit organization that's been around for a little over 40 years. And like I say, I've been involved for about a year and a half, and I'll talk more about that in a minute, but I want to make a couple of disclaimers. Neither I nor Pat nor Sherry are lobbyists, and we do not lobby, and we effectively cannot lobby because of our tax. It gets kind of complicated, but because of our tax exempt status and the way in which we're structured, of course, many nonprofits do lobby and are governed as long as they don't exceed a substantial portion of their expenditures, and that's defined in various ways under the IRS laws, and rules. The Freshwater Society, because of its somewhat unique position, stemming from the source of its revenue, is effectively prohibited for lobbying. So I want to make it clear, we are here at the invitation of the chair, we may make suggestions that are brought from the process we underwent, but we won't be spending time lobbying. And it's important to make that distinction because we are allowed to offer testimony to bodies like this when invited, but not to bother you uninvited. Just for the record, to make sure I said that. You should all have in your possession, in your packets, a document that looks something like this. And let me tell you a little. Tell you a little bit about this. When the Freshwater Society talked to me about joining them in a part-time position, like I say, about a year and a half ago, what they wanted to do at that juncture in its history was to take a look at what are the critical water issues that this organization ought to be allocating its resources towards. When I say allocate its resources, it is an organization that has some endowed resources as well as generates resources from the sale of calendars. You may be familiar with the commercial is the Weather Guide Environment Calendar produced in conjunction with Care 11 Television. One of the largest selling calendars in the region, and quite a good product, I might just mention. At any rate, the Freshwater Society wanted to pull together a group of individuals to look at what are the critical water issues. So we did that, and this is the collection of individuals. This, with the one exception of Bob Eldy, none of these individuals none of these individuals had been involved in the Freshwater Society, and the only one on there that had is Bob Eldy, who in addition serves on the board of directors of the Freshwater Society. So as you can see, and many of the names there I think will be familiar to many of you, folks that, immersed in water issues, people that are immersed in public policy for the most part, and other areas of critical thinking. What we're looking for is people that were critical thinkers that would spend some time and bring their thoughts, expertise, and intelligence to reviewing that issue. And as you can see, it includes Mike Kilgore, who's gotten some fame, some note of late as a member of the Lessard Outdoor Heritage Council, and indeed has been elected, I'm not sure if it's interim or acting chair of the council, serving in that capacity along with, of course, Senator Ingebrigtsen, who serves on that council, and Senator Anderson, who serves on that council. And some other notable people as well. Ron Nargang, former director of the Minnesota Nature Conservancy, former deputy commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources under Commissioner Sando in the from 1991 to 98 in the Carlson administration. Before that, he was director of the Division of Waters in the DNR. And if my memory serves me right, and if not, I'm sure Mr. Knopf can correct me, but I think the original director of the Board of Water and Soil Resources when that was created back in the
1987.
Early 80s. And Mike Osterholm, who's kind of internationally known with his work on epidemiology. And anyhow, just a good collection of folks. And we spent about 6 months talking about major water issues and as members of this committee well know, there's a never-ending list of water problems, water challenges that are facing us. And with the mind of what's critical to get involved in, where can we make a difference if we do get involved in, and these are some of the things we explored at some length. And as we assembled a staff of research people, including most notably Pat and Sherry, to explore these, the council then settled upon the two most critical issues that I'm going to talk about today. Critical and most immediate water issues are groundwater sustainability and non-point source pollution of surface water. Not to say that all those other things were on the previous slide aren't terribly important. Somebody ought to be paying attention to each and every one of those. We decided that's where the freshwater, these two things are where the Freshwater Society in the near future is going to be spending its time about and allocate its resources toward. Findings of our Guardianship Council that we thought were important to understand, and we talk about in the report, is that about 90% of Minnesotans get all or a part of their drinking water from groundwater. And that's significantly higher than the rest of the country. In fact, I don't know if any of the rest of you may have seen the hour and a half special that was on one of the TPT stations here in the Twin Cities last week or in the last 2 weeks anyhow. On water infrastructure, the nation's water infrastructure, they talked about a number of 80% of the nation getting its drinking water from surface water. And that's just something to be aware of, that in Minnesota, we're considerably different than most of the rest of the nation. Now, of course, in the Twin Cities, where Minneapolis and some of the inner ring suburbs connected with Minneapolis is entirely dependent upon the Mississippi River as its water source, that's significantly different than most of the rest of the state. St. Paul, of course, is, much to their credit, has got a system where they use both water drawn from the Mississippi as well as groundwater and have a system that can go either way. Another critical point here on this slide is that this 252 billion gallons of water that we used in 2005 represents a 26% increase from 1991 at a time that the population in the state, and we're talking about the state of Minnesota at this point, increased 18%. And the reason that we had numbers going back for water appropriations and groundwater pumped those years. The reason we used 1991 and 2005 is that, as you can imagine, the amount of water withdrawn varies significantly dependent upon rainfall. because of the irrigation aspect of groundwater usage. And we found that in 1991 and 2005, in this relative time span, were the 2 years that were the most similar in total precipitation for the year. But increase in usage over the last couple of decades that I think is significant. The next chart we talk about in that same time frame, a comparison about where that water is going. And there's a list of uses that you can read there, and I want to make a comment about a few of those because some noticeable things are happening. You'll notice the top line there talks about air conditioning, and you'll see that groundwater pumped for air conditioning has dropped dramatically since 1991. And the members that have been around a while, Senator Stump, Senator Fredrickson, and Senator Vickerman, will remember that back in the late 80s, we passed the ban on once-through cooling of air conditioning. The protocol most typically, and Senator Dill, the protocol most typically in the olden days was, because it was cheaper and simpler, to pump water out of the ground, run it through once, and discharge it into whatever the discharge system was. And, of course, that led to a significant amount, as you can see there, and the dramatic difference of groundwater pumped simply to provide air conditioning. The response by the legislature back in the late 80s, and it took a couple of years to implement, in fact, it hasn't been entirely phased out yet, was to prohibit the design of once-through cooling for air conditioning, for major air conditioning systems. The other thing is you'll notice that the municipal water works, and again, primarily dependent upon groundwater, increased at 26% that we see as a whole for groundwater pumping. The 112% increase over that time frame for golf courses, and maybe we've seen a drop in this since then, I don't know, but this reflects the tremendous increase in the popularity of golf, and golf courses built, expanded during that time period. And just on the subject of golf course sprinkling, and maybe I'll come back to this later, but there's been a lot of conversation of late of the use of water for and in general, and groundwater in particular, for ethanol production, which of course is a fairly intensive use of water. But to put it on a scale on statewide basis, at least up until very recently, golf course sprinkling was running at about twice the rate of ethanol back in these years. So to put it in a scale, golf courses were 2% of water usage, groundwater pumping, and ethanol 1%. But that has been changing dramatically. And, of course, a big change is the major crop irrigation, corn and soybean row cropping. You'll see the jump of some 65% between 91 and 2005. And remember, those are 2 years where the precipitation level in the state was very similar. So we can see that we've had increasing irrigation for crops over that period of time, actual decreases in industrial processing, and like I say, the total use increasing 26% over that time. Other factors that we just talked about in the report, I talked about ethanol production. In the latest years, we had numbers for were 2006, when we saw from 1996 to 2006, no great surprise, there was a six-fold increase in use of groundwater or use of water for ethanol production, up to 1.7 billion gallons. And I expect that when we get the numbers for 2007 and 2008, they'll reflect a continuing increase in use of groundwater for ethanol. We talk about how groundwater is already running short in some areas of the state. For instance, down in the southwestern part of the state, seeking to import in water from South Dakota in connection with the Lewis and Clark, the rural water system down there. It's been something that's been under discussion for a number of years now, and I think they're actually drilling wells in the Missouri Basin down there to supply at least the South Dakota cities that are part of this. I'm not sure if any of it is actually getting to Minnesota as of yet, but I know there are plans to do so. In 2007, the Metropolitan Council identified 18 Twin Cities suburbs where groundwater supplies would not be adequate for the growing population. I know my home community of Coon Rapids, like almost every other city in the outer ring suburbs or second ring suburbs, dependent upon groundwater. Not far from us is the city of Ramsey, where they were one of those 18 Twin City suburbs identified as perhaps not having enough groundwater to meet the city's needs, growth needs in the future. And the other thing that perhaps is obvious but bears statement and emphasis is the interconnection between groundwater and surface water. You know, too often we tend to describe groundwater and surface water as independent ecosystems, and we know for sure they're not. There's a direct connection between groundwater being pumped and what that does to wetlands, streams, rivers, the whole ecosystem of water, surface, and ground is interconnected. One thing that we thought that we ought to be paying some attention to is how we issue our water appropriation permits in the state of Minnesota. Basically done, or they are done, for new wells on a case-by-case basis without regard to cumulative impacts. The system doesn't look at, as borne out in this recent DNR fact sheet, there's currently no standard procedure for evaluating the potential for cumulative reduction in groundwater levels due to pumping from multiple users over a long period of time. We look at these wells as not being a problem until there is a problem. We think that's a little short-sighted. In the area of groundwater sustainability, definitely the most surprising discovery of this guardianship council, and I can certainly say as its chair, is to find the lack of consensus about where we are in sustainability. Indeed, as we went back and gathered evidence going back, as you can see there, over 40 years, there are contradictory reports. The Met Council is saying, I'm sorry, the Department of Conservation, the precursor to the Department of Natural Resources in 1961 is talking then about the metropolitan area approaching a situation where there's a little margin of safety between supply and demand. 1985, the Citizen League issues a report that there is no supply problem now, and there all indications are that we have ample supplies. And you can read those conflicting reports. In 1992, the Met Council says, we think we're going to have a problem. In 2005, we talk about the localized problem that these pumping situations that we're observing and what's happening to the streams and wetlands are not sustainable. If sustainability means it doesn't cause, the pumping doesn't cause adverse impacts on those resources or render water unavailable for future users, then it's not sustainable. More recently, the EQB and the DNR are talking about by the year 2030, a number of counties in the metropolitan area could be using almost all of their renewable water. Because, of course, what's at issue is how fast are we withdrawing water versus how fast are those aquifers recharging? And, of course, it's dangerous to make conclusions based upon a short period of time. I mean, there's a lot of evidence for the fact that the 1990s were among the wettest decades we've had in centuries. So we have to bear in mind that it's not just a year-to-year shift, but a shift that occurs over a considerable period of time, and those aquifers in some instances that we're drawing water that are tens of thousands of years old. And in the Met Council's current, I think that's still a draft water plan, there's an ongoing concern in some areas about water supply. Anyway, as I say, that the groundwater conclusions flow from that observation that we're terribly surprised at the lack of consensus among groundwater experts as to where we are in sustainability and how to measure and model that.
Senator Saxon.
Commissioner, some years ago I read in, I think it was in Time, that Minnesota is the home to the largest unpolluted aquifer in the continental United States. Yeah, I'm assuming it's the Lake Agassiz, Lake Aiken, Lake Wawena area. It goes up through the center of the state. And that, in fact, it didn't used to be the largest unpolluted aquifer. That used to be the Florida Everglades. And something's happened to them. My question is an aquifer that large, will that have any effect on what we're talking about here?
Well,
too far north of a divide? Or?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Saxog, I think that the state of our aquifers and the perceived, at least, abundance of our aquifers will have a lot of effects, because we know that in other parts of the country, large aquifers are unquestionably and significantly depleted, most notably the Oglala Aquifer, which underlies much of the plain state, the western and southwest area. And, you know, there's already discussion about, I remember during this last campaign, one of the unsuccessful candidates for president back early in the process, when a lot of candidates in the primary made reference to the time is now for a national water policy. They've got lots of water in Wisconsin, and we're going to have to get it down to the southwest somehow. So that's something to be thinking about, and I know that even this is, when we talk about the Great Lakes and the phenomenon that the Great Lakes themselves contain 20% of the world's freshwater supply that are not encapsulated in ice. And Lake Superior has a little over half of the volume of water of the Great Lakes. 10% of the world's supply is sitting in Lake Superior. That frequently comes up from time to time. So I think both the size, relative uncontaminated status of the aquifers will probably figure into discussions about a lot of things.
What's the difference between groundwater and an aquifer?
Mr. Chairman, there are people later in the agenda much better to talk about the technical things. But an aquifer is all aquifers are groundwater, and groundwater can be an encapsulated aquifer within rock, or it can be saturated soil conditions. And oftentimes it's a matter of degrees. But there are better people later to ask that question.
All right. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, just a question backing up to the production of ethanol. You said that we're continuously using more and more water for that. Is that because our production is up?
Yes.
Or are they – what am I to think of this? The theory that I hear that we're actually doing a better job – we're not using 5 gallons of water. We're doing a better job of recycling. Is that fair? Or is that?
Well, it is fair. Okay. Mr. Chairman and Senator Ingebrigtsen, I'm glad you asked that question because on a per gallon of ethanol produced, we're getting much more efficient. I think it's in that 4 to 5 gallon range yet, my understanding. But it's been coming down as we've gotten more efficient, no question.
Thank you.
But we've been producing more ethanol.
Right.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Vickerman.
You could say that, but both plants recycle that water. 3 plants in my district recycle that water. That water is not just thrown away. They recycle it because they know how much tougher water is to get out there in my area. So they do recycle it.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Vickerman, I don't want to dispute that because you can see here our data is 2 to 3 going on 4 years old, and I'm sure there have been changes in the ethanol production. And bear in mind we're talking about, of course, corn-based ethanol here, and that can change. And the one thing I want to make note of while we're back on the subject of ethanol is that actually the production, if what we're doing with producing more ethanol is growing more corn and we're irrigating to grow the corn, the amount of irrigation to grow the corn is exponentially greater than the amount of water. The amount of water used to do the irrigation is exponentially greater than the amount of water used in the production cycle.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As long as we're helping ourselves to asking specific questions about, and tell me, Commissioner, if we can wait with a question like this. I was curious about the municipal water use piece, where you showed that municipal water had pumping had increased 26%. Do we know the major factors driving that kind of increase? Because over the same period, you said population increased 18%. Are we just sending more municipal water service to more development that didn't have it previously, folks who are pumping water out of their own wells, or are we using more on a per capita, per household basis? Does that also include water that we're using for commercial industrial purposes? Mr. Merriam.
Yeah, the municipal water here includes what is pumped to go into a municipal system. Mm-hmm. Maybe flip that slide back on. So that includes wherever it's being metered to from that municipal system. But if you think about what's driving additional municipal use, a growth of households. You mentioned per capita. I would rather think of it on a per household basis, mm-hmm. because per capita size of households are going down. But size of lawns aren't going down. Mm-hmm. So as you think about expanding suburban areas and our great worship of mowed lawns and growing grass has, I think, a significant feature in any of that.
Thank you. Go ahead and continue with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And anyhow, getting back to the Guardianship Council's recommendations to the Freshwater Society Board of Directors and their conclusions, given this lack of consensus, we thought it was important that there be a scientifically rigorous study of what's happening and what our status is. And so we've made that a major thrust of the Freshwater Society's efforts, at least into the near future. Simultaneously, fitting within the Freshwater Society's long-believed mission statement that conservation, protection, and rehab of groundwater, of all water resources, including groundwater, was critical. So. We're convinced it's important to preach of groundwater conservation, but we think it's also critical to engage others in that scientific study of what's happening. How do we model, how do we determine what's happening? How do we model it? Because we talk about aquifers, but it's a fairly complex, because it isn't just one aquifer that underlines this region or the various parts of the state, but it's multiple aquifers at multiple depths. And we are working with currently with the University of Minnesota Water Resources Center at the university, and we've begun co-sponsoring an effort that's led to what we expect to be a series of workshops. We held the first of that back in the 12th of November, and it was well received and well attended by the scientist types that we invited that, just to try to get a handle on what it is that affects groundwater sustainability. And I describe it as answering the questions, what is it we don't know? Because we find out there's more that we don't know than what we do know when it comes to the sustainability of our groundwater. What is it we need to know? And how are we going to get that data that describes that? So we've launched that, like I say, with the University of Minnesota Water Resources Center, with the co-directors there that include both Faye Sleeper and Deb Schwackhammer, both of whom I think are familiar with a number of people here. And we've also engaged in our planning groups with this and involved in these workshops people from the DNR, the EQB, the Department of Health, the U.S. Geological Survey, the Minnesota Geological Survey, the Met Council, and the Minnesota Groundwater Association. Hopefully I've included all of those. And it's a group of people that bring a great deal of knowledge to the table. Kind of a daunting task to figure out where we are and how our pumping of groundwater relates in the various parts of the state relates to our sustainability and that recharge. Okay, on the issue of groundwater quality, because we talk about uncontaminated aquifers, but we can't take that for granted. In fact, we're finding out with greater and greater frequency that they're not all entirely contaminated. Because if we're going to talk about sustainable water use into the future, the quality of the water is as important as the quantity. And, of course, much of that groundwater goes back to the periods of the glaciers, particularly the deeper aquifers, and we are recharging the more shallow aquifers with chemicals from what we're doing on the land. We're accustomed, of course, to thinking about what we do on the land affects our surface water and the quality of our surface water. But going back to what I described earlier of the interconnection between our surface water and our groundwater and how we're recharging our aquifers, what we're doing on the land affects sooner or later what's in those aquifers as well. And we've got some areas of the state that are more vulnerable to the others. We talked here about the central plain, or the sand plains of central Minnesota and some areas near Hastings where we've got very porous soil conditions and shallow aquifers that bring those seepages from our land practices down to the aquifers very quickly. We also finding in many areas of the state that both farm fertilizers and evidence of failed septic systems have been found in elevated concentrations in aquifers and wells in central and southeastern Minnesota, as well as parts of the Twin Cities. Made mention of atrazine there, that some evidence that we are doing a better job of how we're dispensing it, but still finding concentrations with increasing frequency. Oftentimes a time lag between something that happens on the land and when it shows up on an aquifer.
That's
and I know that there are members of this committee that are very involved in some of these discussions about the volatile organic compounds found in the groundwaters in the Twin Cities and the St. Cloud area, the PFCs that we found in a number of places, and treated wastewaters, and realizing once again that some 40% of the septic systems that we have in the state don't comply with state standards and they threaten both groundwater and surface water. Now, before somebody accuses me of overstating that, that's not to say that we have evidence of failure of 40% of the septic systems, but that the best estimate is that 40% do not meet current standards. In the area of groundwater quality recommendations of the council was a discussion of the need for intensified groundwater monitoring, including those low-level contaminants. Hopefully find the problem before it gets deeper and deeper into the aquifers and see how it can be remedied. Doing the research on pollutants and their synergistic interactions. And one thing to think about the perhaps the what makes groundwater contamination even more critical than surface water contamination. There's a lot of contaminants that will break down over time in the surface water with exposure to air and sunlight and things like that that lead to a chemical breakdown. You get it below ground in the aquifers, and those chemical breakdowns are no longer occurring, and it's lasting a lot longer or in virtually in perpetuity in the groundwaters. One thing that we've talked about is the need to protect aquifers and groundwater recharge areas from contamination. Of course, that it becomes exceedingly difficult in this state because virtually the entire state is a groundwater recharge area. But I've noticed, and now that I've had some time to do traveling over the last decade, and driving around the countryside and seeing in other states, I don't think I've seen it anywhere in Minnesota, signs that come up that say groundwater recharge area. And I talked to people because I wondered, what does that mean? What is that telling me to do? And finding out that in those areas, they have special regulations, special zoning, special prohibitions because they don't want what's happening on the land to get down into those aquifers. We don't have those in Minnesota because virtually the entire state is a groundwater recharge area, getting down there sooner or later. The other major subject, as I said, that were two main thrusts of where the our guardianship council urged the Freshwater Society to get involved in the area of surface water pollution, the non-point source pollution. And of course, I know that this committee has had a fair amount of exposure to the impaired waters phenomenon. We continue to test, but we've yet, believed to hit 20% of our surface waters to be tested, and we continue to find that of those that we test, 40% of them are impaired. We find this map is not meant to highlight exactly. It shows where those impairments are. The takeaway point is they're everywhere. And rivers and lakes throughout the state, geographically dispersed, are within that 40% that have been tested impaired. Just a little slide to show the breakdown of those pollutants as described in the Impaired Waters Program. Not surprisingly, the lion's share of it, exotic chemicals, including the mercury and principally coming from atmospheric deposition, the eutrophication coming from the excessive nutrients, nitrogen and phosphorus that's getting in, and so on the list. On the area of surface water pollution, as I say, that we break it down between point source and non-point source, 14% of it is coming from point sources, sewage treatment sources, and others that are regulated. And just to take a moment to celebrate our successes, those of us that are old enough to remember in the late 60s, early 70s, when we had the phenomenon of the Cuyahoga River and Cleveland catching fire and Lake Erie being virtually a dead sea from all the pollutants and the problems in this state from a lot of sources. The Clean Water Act was passed by the federal government, by Congress, in 1972. And over the course of almost four decades since then, we've made tremendous strides with respect to point source pollution, inadequate or non-existent wastewater treatment going into our rivers, streams, and lakes. We've made a tremendous investment in wastewater treatment plants, industrial discharges that were cleaned up and shut down. We've made great strides when you measure the point source pollution. But what's left, and I might say great successes in this state, two of the most notable ones are the St. Louis River emptying into the Lake Superior at Duluth. You know, when he was alive, Representative Munger, throughout the late 80s into the 90s, insisted we go fishing in the St. Louis River at least once a year because it was great. You could catch and eat the walleyes in the St. Louis River. And it was a good fishery because it wasn't that long before that where because of the upstream discharges, principally the paper mills, there wasn't a viable fishery. So among Willard Munger's proudest accomplishments was the cleanup of the St. Louis River, and he liked to show that off. Similarly, in the Rainy River has become a fantastic walleye fishery, but more symbolic of its recovery is its restoration as a sturgeon fishery, because the sturgeon are even more susceptible to those polluted waters. And a great symbol of the success of the cleanup, and again, it's the point sources that were cleaned up and made significant differences across the country as well as in Minnesota. What's left is the hard part, the 86% of our surface water pollutants from non-point sources. Runoff from farms, lawns, streets, parking lots, and atmospheric deposition. And in here, we've got the breakdown of the notable ones. The numbers for agricultural runoff and the percentage of contribution to our non-point source pollution runs, the lowest I've seen is 60%, and it runs up from there. So the lion's share of our non-point source pollution, of our polluted surface waters in this state is agricultural runoff. And you can't talk about that without talking about ditching, drainage, and dams. We've made great strides in some respects with the almost two decades old passage of the Wetlands Conservation Act. But the fact remains that we have something like 20,000 miles of tile going into the state every year. That's 2.5 times around the earth. And another culprit is urban storm water runoff, and it's a significant contributor. We'll talk about more about that in a minute. Relating it to the problem in the Gulf with the epoxia down there, the U.S. Geological Survey has identified that 70% of the nitrogen and phosphorus flowing into the Gulf of Mexico comes from agricultural runoff. A significant contributor to that is from the Minnesota River and as it flows into the Mississippi here in our state. Of that nitrogen and phosphorus, 9 to 12% comes from urban runoff. And on the subject of urban runoff, this is just a little slide. I don't want you to try to even begin to grasp that detail. Just look at the dark spots, because when we identify the impervious surface, the darker the area, the more impervious surfaces. And impervious surfaces have an effect both on quantity as well as quality of water going into surface water, because water that would otherwise replenish the aquifers and in the groundwater runs off to the streams, rivers, and is flushed out of the system, so we're holding less and flushing more. And every time we put in another impervious surface, streets, roads, parking lots, sidewalks, you understand the program, we are contributing to that problem, as well as the quality problem, because it's carrying off the things that we do on that land, how we use our automobiles, and how we use and abuse the land. One of the things that came to my attention recently, and I borrowed with attribution because I think it's a great line, is the fact that we have to recognize that every street is a tributary of the river, and it's carrying off whatever we're doing on that street. We didn't design in the urban area, and having served on a growing city council 35 years ago that was busily building houses and putting in storm sewers, I share a good deal of guilt when I say, what were we thinking of? We knew what the problem was. The problem was standing water. We knew how to get rid of it. We put pipes in the ground and put those pipes out to the river, and there it went. So that's my confession for the day.
Yeah. We want to leave some time for questions.
Okay, I think we're almost done, Mr. Yeah. Chairman. We wanted to just mention the emerging contaminants that we're finding more and more evidence of problems. Studies done on these endocrine disruptors and changing the biology, literally, of the fish populations. And recognizing that it's leading to problems, and it's coming about from things, how we live our lives and what the chemicals we're using and putting in and out of our body and go into the treatment centers that aren't designed to treat for those particular chemicals. Everything from pharmaceuticals to the other things we use in our daily lives. Okay, the recommendation of the council to deal with that is, you can see identified here, is to the impaired water. We got to move impaired waters. We got to move on with that program. We need to change our culture as it relates to the agricultural runoff problem. I think the simple description would be, if we don't bring about a cultural shift and continue to grow what we're currently growing in the places we're currently growing it, in the manner in which we're growing it, we're not going to make a dent in non-point source pollution. I think we have to understand that and figure out how we're going to deal with it. We ought to be looking at how we can, how we as a government, can, if we're going to get people to change their practices, and compensate them to make sure we focus our resources where the problem is. We need to explore dealing with this emerging problem of the endocrine disruptors with medications and personal products. Additional things I just want to talk about in passing, because they didn't rank among the top two major categories of our guardianship council, but things that came up that wanted to talk about. For additional water resource considerations is to think about water pricing structure. We treat water like it's free. The only thing we pay for the only thing I pay for when I get a water bill from my city that's pumping water out of that ground is the cost of getting it from the ground, from the aquifers, to my house. There's no value of that thing as it sits in the aquifer. And I think that our culture has evolved around that phenomenon. We have to recognize that climate change is probably going to change, is probably going to have some effect on our water. Disagreement as to what happens, but I think one of the consensus that seems to be evolving is that we will have more storm events, that we'll get our precipitation and bigger storm episodes. And that has implications for our water quantity and quality, because more of it will run off as opposed to seeping into the groundwater, and it'll carry away eroded banks as well as the other things that are flushed out in the rains. So while I put up that final thought to conclude my presentation, it's what we're looking for is a cultural shift. It's kind of fun, if you'll indulge me, Mr. Chairman, as you begin a new session here, and I think back to all the cultural shifts that have happened from in the intervening 34 years that I first showed up in this building to come to grips with public policy, and you think of the strides we've made in all these cultural shifts that occurred in recycling and using seat belts and smoking and drinking and driving. A lot of significant shifts, and we think when it comes to using and conserving water, there are things to do that require a cultural shift. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Do you have any questions?
By and large, then, is groundwater recharged for the most part by stormwater? Is that fair to say?
Well, groundwater recharge is by precipitation. Every time it rains or snows, some portion of that replenishes the groundwater. How much depends upon a lot of factors, where it falls, and how rapidly it falls.
But it's fair to say that our groundwater, the water that we drink, 90% of what we drink, is recharged by what falls from the sky and what it picks up along the way back down it underground.
Absolutely.
So then the next question is, and maybe this is better for the PCA, but I appreciate your thoughts. We talk about the Clean Water Legacy Act, assessing impaired waters, and calculating total maximum daily loads of our lakes, streams, and rivers. To your knowledge, is that same assessment being done for groundwater aquifers?
Mr. Chairman, no. I've not heard anybody talking about doing.
All right. Thank you. Senator Anderson, and go ahead and throw up your hands. We'll get you on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Merriam, I just want to follow up on what you said, Mr. Chair. I was thinking about the sustainability of groundwater, because you talk a lot about that in here. And do you all have any conclusions about how to establish standards for sustainable use of our groundwater? What should we do, and what do you recommend we do? And I have a second question, if I may, after that.
Mr. Merriam.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Anderson, what we should do runs the gamut, not too dissimilar to the surface water. What becomes important is leaving the water where it falls. The closer you can leave the water, whether it's rain gardens, whether it's collecting it in rain barrels and using that to water our gardens. So that's the first observation. That we're best off leaving water where it falls most often. The second is understanding and recognizing that what we do on the land, just as it affects our surface water, affects the groundwater. Because if we're leaving it pooled in contaminated areas, it's going to get into the groundwater sooner or later. So it's containment and management of hazardous materials that we're creating, and I don't mean hazardous in the strictest definition under the Waste Management Act, but stuff that is deleterious to the groundwater.
Follow up.
Well, Mr. Chair, maybe you're right that we need a clean water legacy law for our groundwater, and you know we don't even know how much groundwater we have, much less are we beginning to test and monitor it all. So I think that's an area that we've only started to look at and we need to do a lot of work on. You know, the other question I have is about the management of water. I've heard a lot about this in recent months since the passage of the Clean Water Amendment, in particular about how complicated the management of our water is, and it's under the jurisdiction of so many different agencies and entities. And it, you mentioned in your report that there's been 17 reports. I mean, if we want to commission another study, that might give us a little pause. 17 reports on state water organization over the last 30 years. But as far as I know, nothing's ever come out of these studies. So do you have any recommendations about how to change or reform or improve our management of water?
Mr. Merriam.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Anderson, it's with some trepidation I even get into this subject matter because, as you mentioned, we went back and looked. One of the phenomena that I've observed is that, and it's not unique to water, but it probably shows up in this area as much as any. Anytime you have a complicated governance structure involving federal, state, and multiple local agencies, all charged with some portion of governance, there's a natural inclination to think that if we just fix the governance, we'd fix the problems. Clearly, if you looked at the and this came up early on in our discussions at the Guardianship Council, because one thing everybody wants to understand, and it's good they do, is okay, who's in charge of what? And you start putting up those organization charts and duties that are in the statutes, and the reaction, understandably, is what a complicated mess. How can anybody make sense of this? Let's fix the organizational structure. And for two reasons, I discourage the council from going down that path as a major thrust. And it's having seen those, many of those 17 reports that you made reference to in our report evolve, it led to a good deal of frustration because, well, I wouldn't design a system, and I don't think collectively we'd design the system we have now. Changing it requires a great deal of energy. And as I've watched people trying to change it over the decades, and I wouldn't say that nothing has ever changed. Bowser evolved from one or more of those reports. And a number of good things have happened from a number of those reports. They weren't all wasted motion. I just, first of all, didn't want to experience that one more time. Also believe that there were more important things to focus on rather than changing the organizational structure. Not to say that it wouldn't merit doing, but
Senator Dibble. Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, a comment. This issue of the drier areas of our country looking to the wetter areas of our country is the real one. And we got to start on talking about that as a state and legislature with the Interstate Compact that's going to govern the withdrawals from Lake Superior. So that's good. But there's a lot more water around that is being eyeballed, as you touched on. And boy, if you want to talk about tense political conversations and competition for resources, I've gone to a number of national gatherings of state legislators, and I've had the opportunity to eavesdrop on Georgia, Tennessee, Alabama, Florida legislators as they've argued about the water resource in that area. Likewise, I've eavesdropped on California, Nevada, Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona legislators, and you just see the Colorado River, and it's become a trickle down Baja. part of Mexico because they've drawn so much out of there. So that's a real issue, and we probably need to deal with it pretty promptly as a state, what we think about that and what kind of policies we're going to need to enact. Likewise, I was really interested in the conversation you touched on with development in the metropolitan area and the pervious and impervious and what that means for runoff and the like. Do you anticipate that recommendations will emerge around land use and sprawl? Likewise, what kind of surfaces we're putting? I know there's a lot of literal practices. You know, we've got some studies out at the Landscape Arboretum and other places that show that we can build parking surfaces and roads and other things that are better than they are now. They don't just run off. So do you think some significant policy recommendations might emerge, both around land use, sprawl, looking at our water and establishing some goals for that, but also where we do develop, some better practices might emerge?
Mr. Merriam.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, I certainly hope so, and I expect. I'm glad you made mention of the Minnesota Landscape Arboretum. We've spent some time with them. They are they have a great exhibit that you made reference to that graphically shows in a space probably the size of this room or less. Pools of water dependent upon just subtle changes and how you manage the runoff. They are unveiling an exhibit this summer at the Landscape Arboretum. They're calling Waterosity, making that linkage to people that are interested in gardening and nurseries and trees and flowers, of the connection between water use. So we think in our role as educating people, because I'm a firm believer that it to make these cultural shifts, we need some element. It's the consent of the governed becomes important. It's a combination of education, regulation, enforcement that's going to get people to change what they're doing. And we've got to do a better job of educating people, citizens and local officials, and hopefully, and you're already starting to see it with some of the regulations in some communities, how they're designing and requiring commercial parking lots to be designed with less impervious surface. And that all makes a difference. It's graphically depicted at that display out at the Landscape Arboretum. And I'm sure going on from there is to, with that exhibit of metropolitan sprawl, how that figures into the equation. These are all factors. One of the things that I think we've not paid much attention to in designing our metropolitan system, even where water's available. It's coming as a surprise to some people. All of us have been spoiled, I think, by a mentality wherever we lived, almost wherever we lived, that if your well runs dry, you dig a deeper one. And that's the solution to the problem. There are areas in this state, in this metropolitan area, where that won't work. And people have to come to grips with that. And I think we've got to build that into our design standards when we're looking at density of population and everything else we do. Highways, that should all be factored in.
Senator Dill, and then we've got to get to the next two reports.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Merriam, I would like to have some estimate from you or somebody as to the breakdown on the amount of land in Minnesota in various categories to more accurately reflect what this really means. Now, you're saying 60 to 70% of the pollution is from agricultural runoff, but what percent of the land in Minnesota is in agricultural use? And does that include pasture land or forest land? And you say 10 to 15% is from suburban and city developments. What percent of the land in Minnesota is in urbanized areas? The point I'm trying to get at is that if 10 to 15% of the runoff is from city and suburban areas, if, for example, only 5% of the surface area of the state is in suburban and city developments, and 60 to 70% of the land is in agricultural use and responsible for 60-70% of the pollution. You know, perhaps the city area is responsible on a per square mile basis for twice as much pollution as agricultural areas. Or do you follow what I'm talking about?
Equivalent to the land mass in each category.
Mr. Merriam.
In other words, what is a pollution rate per acre or per square mile based on different land use practices? In the forest areas, is a certain amount of land in forest areas, and how much pollution comes off of those areas? And I guess a simple question was how much of the state is in agricultural use?
You know,
Mr. Merriam.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dill, back to your original question, you want me or somebody to answer that. And I'm sure somebody can. I know I can. I'm sure we could figure out that. I don't have that number.
Tom Peterson.
Well, the point I'm trying to make is that it looks like agriculture is responsible for a lot of pollution, but maybe based on the amount of real estate they're using, it isn't as much as you might think. And maybe the urban areas are responsible for a lot more based on what part of the real estate they're using and the part they're contributing. So
your question is about proportionality,
right?
Senator Dillon. I think it's a fair one. It's my understanding that 50% of Minnesota's land surface is in agricultural use. I can't say what percentage is actually urbanized, but I wouldn't say that it was the other half. It was somewhat smaller. So the impression that are you saying 33?
Yes.
Page 33. So the impression that I'm
document.
The impression that I glean is that since 6% of our land coverage is, according to this report, is urban development, but 10 to 12% contributes to pollution, for lack as a general term. The impression that I glean off of that, Senator Deal, is that there's a problem in both areas that needs to be addressed equally. So I'm reading your concern that we don't want to blame agriculture entirely for our water pollution, and I think that's fair. But so I think we need to, from my point of view, we need to come away with the impression that there's a problem with agricultural runoff and there's a problem with urban runoff as well. And both of them need to be addressed if we truly want to get at this issue. Thank you, gentlemen, for your comments. And these two are very accessible. Of course, for those of you who don't know, Mr. Merriam was the media predecessor to the current DNR commissioner and, of course, had a long history as a Minnesota State Senator, including the Environment Committee. Next on the agenda is a report from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Citizen monitoring of surface water quality. Shannon Lothammer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And
welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. If you'll just bear with me for a moment, I'll get that presentation.
While we're waiting, we had two additional staff members come in the room. I had mentioned Gloria Gunbill, DFL Research, and Dan Mueller, who is the Environment Committee's fiscal analyst, mainly the Environment Finance Committee, but we do impact finance in some of the things we do, for better or for worse, and so we appreciate him being with us. Ms. Lothammer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Shannon Lothammer, and I'm the manager of the water monitoring section at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And I appreciate the opportunity to provide the committee with an overview of our 2009 citizen monitoring report to the legislature.
Ms. Lothammer, is it fair for me to interject at this point that the word quality at the beginning of your report is key for purposes of the PCA? Because the the duties in our water management are split between the DNR and the PCA. In general, the DNR is responsible for water quantity in general, and the PCA is responsible for water quality.
Mr. Chair, yes, that is correct. Okay. That's a good way of thinking about it.
Okay.
The only addition that I would make to that is that just recognizing the previous conversation that had a lot to do with groundwater, that in the groundwater arena, there another principal player would be the Minnesota Department of Health, and they're focused on drinking water quality as well.
Thank you.
Today, what I'll be providing you with is an overview of our 2009 legislative report on citizen monitoring of surface water quality. And what I'll plan on doing is provide some brief background, talk about how citizen monitoring fits into our overall strategy for monitoring the state's water resources, and again, for monitoring the quality of the state's water resources, and then talk about our progress, challenges, and future opportunities within this arena. So first, a little bit of background. Minnesota has long recognized the many benefits of citizen monitoring. Citizen monitoring in our state actually dates back to the early 1970s with the advent of the Citizen Lake Monitoring Program, which started back in 1973. And programs like Citizen Lake and Citizen Stream Monitoring really reinforce the Pollution Control Agency's mission, which is working with Minnesotans to protect, conserve, and improve our environment and enhance our quality of life. The citizen monitoring does include a variety of efforts and sponsors, and I would be remiss if I even implied that it was just the Pollution Control Agency that supports citizen monitoring efforts in the state. There are a number of organizations ranging from other state agencies, local units of government such as watershed districts and cities and counties, and also nonprofit organizations such as Minnesota Waters, which is a statewide nonprofit, and educational institutions like the University of Minnesota Extension Service, all of which have a role to play in supporting citizen monitoring, and all of which the Pollution Control Agency regularly coordinates with to support this important effort. In addition to generating valuable data that is used for understanding the quality of our water resources, citizen monitoring really provides many other important benefits, such as promoting a local understanding of the health of our water resources, and also fostering local participation in water resource management efforts, both by helping people understand how their activities on the land connects to water quality, similar to some of the needs that Mr. Merriam was talking about earlier, and then also getting people more involved and engaged in that local planning effort, and also providing that information both on the local and the state level. And one nice thing about citizen monitoring is that participation has been increasing since that start back in 1973. In 2002, the Rivers Council of Minnesota, which now actually joined with the Lakes Association to create Minnesota Waters, they actually estimated that there were 4,000 volunteers across the state participating in citizen monitoring in one way or another. And really, due to this increasing interest and the increasing role of citizen monitoring, back in 2002, the Minnesota legislature passed a law that really enables the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency to encourage citizen monitoring by developing and promoting programs, providing technical assistance, integrating citizen monitoring into our assessment efforts, so we're using that data as a way to help us understand the health of our water resources. And then that statute also has a provision for a biennial progress report to the legislature on our progress with all of these activities. That our first progress report was completed in 2003, so this is the fourth progress report that we've provided. So one way that the Pollution Control Agency promotes citizen monitoring is by explicitly recognizing that this monitoring is a key component of our overall effort to monitor Minnesota's water resources. Now, back in 2004, the Pollution Control Agency completed a comprehensive water quality monitoring strategy, which really lays out what are the overall approaches and goals to monitoring our state's water resources. One of the primary goals of that strategy is to monitor and assess lakes and streams on a 10-year cycle. And citizen monitoring is one of the four components that makes up how we're going to actually achieve that goal of monitoring our lakes and streams. So we have monitoring that's done by the Pollution Control Agency staff, monitoring by other organizations, such as other state agencies, federal agencies, local units of government, like watershed districts and soil and water conservation districts, Then there's monitoring that's done by local citizens. And finally, we use remote sensing data, which is satellite imagery that can give us a snapshot picture of water quality, particularly for lakes. And we can use that then as a way to prioritize additional follow-up monitoring. So this monitoring really explicitly recognized that citizen monitoring is part of this overall whole of achieving a better understanding of our water quality. Beyond this monitoring strategy, the Pollution Control Agency's citizen monitoring support takes several forms. We do have two monitoring programs that we directly administer. We provide financial assistance to local groups by passing through funding under the Clean Water Legacy Act resources that we received over the past biennium. And then we also provide technical assistance through partnerships and training events and through authoring guidance materials that we make available to local groups to help them understand what information is needed to be able to use data for assessment purposes and actually what options are out there for citizen monitoring efforts as well. It's also very important to point out, and this is kind of emphasizing a point that I've already brought up, that we're just one of many agencies and organizations that support citizen volunteer efforts. So we partner with a number of groups in order to provide these services so we can really engage citizens at the local level, and they become an important part of our water monitoring efforts. These next two slides go a little bit more in depth into the monitoring efforts that the Pollution Control Agency directly supports by administering programs. The first is the Citizen Lake Monitoring Program, which again is our longest living monitoring program or citizen monitoring program in the state. It actually started back in 1973 at the University of Minnesota with 74 lakes that were monitored. And in 1978, the program was transferred to the Pollution Control Agency, and we've been administering it since then. And you can see the growth that we've seen in those, 30-some years of the program's history. In fact, we do have some volunteers that have been with the Citizen Lake Monitoring Program for 35 years. They were just recognized. I think there were about three of them. So it's pretty exciting to see the growth in the program and also the fact that a lot of times citizens that get involved continue to stay involved because they really appreciate learning about their local water resource, knowing that their data has value to the state of Minnesota, and also being able to make use of that data on a local level. A second program that we work with, the Citizen Stream Monitoring Program, was created back in 1998 to provide a similar type of experience for citizens that are interested in stream water quality as the Citizen Lake Monitoring Program does for lake water quality. And what both of these programs are really based on, what the citizens are measuring, is the clarity or transparency of the water, how clear the water is, which correlates very well with how clean the water is as well. And we all know that if we walk out into a lake and you walk out to knee deep and you can see your toes, that's probably a lake that you're interested in swimming in. And if you walk out to knee deep and you can't see your toes, you're maybe not so interested. And that very clear, very easy measure of clarity translates into water quality information that's very valuable for the state and for local government decision-making as well. And it's actually quite easy for citizens to collect. And so in the case of the lake monitoring program, the citizens use a tool or a technique called a Secchi disc to measure the clarity. And then for the stream monitoring program, it's a very similar type of measurement using what's called a transparency tube. But again, with the stream monitoring, you can see that the interest has continued to increase as well. We started with 22 locations. We now have almost 500 volunteers that are monitoring more than 800 sites across the state. And the Pollution Control Agency works very hard to recruit and to retain our volunteers by providing regular communication with them, by putting out annual letters to kick off the monitoring season, get people revved up, remind them what they need to be doing. We have newsletters that we provide that provide tips for monitoring and also recognize those volunteers that have been with our program for 5, 10, 15, and in some cases 35 years. And the other thing that we do is we provide support activities that include training, data management, providing year-end reports, and then also, and I think for a lot of our citizens, one of the most important things is recognizing that we use that data and information in our assessment process to really assess the health of our water resources. And again, the Pollution Control Agency isn't the only group that's providing this sort of support, but I think it is important to acknowledge that providing that support to those citizens is very important to the continued interest of citizens in the program and the continued longevity of citizen monitoring efforts as well.
How do one of our constituents get involved with
doing this type of thing
sure.
for their lake?
If they're interested in their lake, they can go on to the Pollution Control Agency's website. And actually on our front page, there's a volunteer monitoring link that they can click on. And there they'll find the program information about who exactly to contact, sign-up sheets, what it involves to be a volunteer, and all of that information. Another Pollution Control Agency effort that involves supporting citizen monitoring is pass-through funding that is being provided in the form of surface water assessment grants. With the passage of the 2006 Clean Water Legacy Act and associated funding, the PCA was able to provide grants to local groups to conduct assessment monitoring and really to emphasize the use of volunteers in that process. So in fiscal years 2007 and 2008, about $3 million was granted out to these local groups for these monitoring efforts. And you can see the breakdown of the proposals. There were a lot of local units of government that applied, some university and college groups, and then also nonprofit organizations. So most often what happens is a local group, whether it's a local governmental unit or a nonprofit organization, will make an application, and then they will provide those coordination services and involve local citizens in the collection effort. So the citizens get that local support and involvement. They have the opportunity to participate. And the great thing for the state is we get the very important data in return that we can use to help extend our reach and extend our understanding of our water resources. This year we have a little more than $2 million to grant out for fiscal year 2009. And we've received 43 applications in, and we're just right now in the process of evaluating those applications and making those awards. And as a result of the monitoring from 2007 and 2008, so all of the dots and the blobs that you can kind of see on this map, we have more than 475 lakes and 170 stream sites that are being monitored across Minnesota. And that data then is provided to the state to be able to use, for us to use, to assess the status of those lakes and streams and how healthy they are. This next slide gives you a sense for trends in citizen monitoring. And this is just now tracking our citizen lake and our citizen stream monitoring efforts, because that's the data that we have most readily available. And then in future years, we would like to add in the citizen or the surface water assessment grant information on that as well to show how volunteers are participating in that effort. But as you can see, the participation is continuing to grow. And again, many of these citizens are not only partnering with us, but they're also partnering with local groups and providing that information on the local level as well. Now, with that said, lest I give you the idea that citizen monitoring is kind of the end-all and be-all of our monitoring efforts, I do want to point out that there are some challenges associated with citizen monitoring that we just need to recognize and be aware of as we continue to promote this effort. One of the challenges is that we don't always have interested volunteers where we need the data. So again, this is based on voluntary efforts, local citizens being interested, and them getting involved because they care about their lake or their stream. And there's other lakes and streams in Minnesota that we also need to know about. And so that's where the local units of government doing monitoring, state agency monitoring, and federal monitoring also plays a very significant role in order to fill in those gaps. The other thing that I wanted to point out is that not all of the monitoring that's needed to really understand the health of our water resources is real conducive to the use of volunteers. Some of it is just very highly technical or requires more specialized equipment. For example, some of the biological monitoring that we do involves using fish shocking equipment. So you temporarily stun the fish so you can actually measure how big they are and what kind of fish you're finding and things like that. That's not the kind of activity that's real conducive to citizen monitoring. We also have some monitoring that requires that you be there at a specific time on a specific day in order to get the sample when you really need to get the sample. And again, working with volunteers, many of which are retired, they maybe don't want to be there at 5 o'clock in the morning to get a dissolved oxygen sample at the correct time of day. So while citizens are a component of our monitoring effort and an important component, those other components are important as well. And then again, effective citizen monitoring does require that we have that either local or state level of support to provide the training and the data entry and the quality assurance review to make sure that it's quality data that's being collected, that it can be used for the purposes for which we'd like to use it, and then also to make sure that the citizens are getting the feedback that they need to understand how their data is being used and also how important it is to the system. So with that said, just a little bit now about where we're heading with this effort of citizen monitoring. One thing that I'd like to point out is that we're looking towards doing more targeting of our recruitment effort. If you look at kind of the trends of our citizen monitoring or numbers of citizens that are involved, you might be able to see a little bit of a plateau, maybe. One of the things that we're wondering is if we've kind of reached the limit of sort of the all-comers approach to citizen monitoring, where we put, you know, general calls for participation out there and people respond. One idea that we have to really try to continue to increase the number of citizens involved is to get more and more targeted with our recruiting efforts. One of the things that the PCA has done is for our 10-year monitoring cycle, where we're looking to cycle through all of the state's watersheds over 10 years, we've actually preliminarily selected all of the monitoring sites for that monitoring effort. So we have about 900 sites that at a certain level of detail and about 3,600 additional sites where sometime in the next 10 years, the PCA or local governments are going to be out doing monitoring in order to complete this watershed assessment. What we'd like to do is really try to get citizen volunteers monitoring at each of those sites as well, so that the PCA will be there for about 2 years to conduct that once every 10-year assessment. And then we'd like to have citizens there for the remaining 8 years so we can track how that watershed changes over time before the cycle repeats itself and we can get back out there to do additional assessments. So that targeted recruiting, we think, is one great opportunity for further involving citizens and really continuing to link up our citizen monitoring effort with our overall statewide assessment efforts for our lakes and streams. The other thing that watershed approach does is it really sets the stage for planning and implementation activities as well. So if we can get local groups and local individuals involved with their lakes and streams at the outset when we're doing the monitoring, they're that much ready to participate in the planning efforts. If we have a problem that needs to be corrected or we have good quality resources that we want to continue to protect, those informed local citizens can really become nuclei for continued action in that watershed to make sure that those desired activities occur. We anticipate that we'll continue to see increasing participation, and we also are working more closely with local units of government to recruit those citizen volunteers and get them involved in that watershed approach and in that overall approach of monitoring our water resources. And then finally, that partnership is going to continue to be an important part of this overall approach. So that's a very brief overview of kind of our progress with citizen monitoring at the state level and some of the things that we've seen as far as what's happened over the last couple of years and what we're hoping to see in the future. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Questions for Ms. Lauthammer. Ms. Lauthammer, what are some practical or some real-life examples of how a citizen monitor shaped the future of their lake, river, stream, or watershed in Minnesota?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, a good example that I can think of actually harkens back. Before I came back to the Pollution Control Agency, I actually worked with the Watershed District in Scott County, and we had citizen volunteers that participated in the state's Citizen Lake Monitoring Program effort. And then we also had a local effort partnering with Metropolitan Council to do lake monitoring of Upper Prior Lake, Lower Prior Lake, and Spring Lake in that watershed district in northern Scott County. And one example would be, I always remember one of our citizen volunteers who was very involved in monitoring Prior Lake, and he actually got involved in our planning processes at the local level as well. So he would come to our watershed district meetings because he knew about the quality of the lake. He understood how water quality worked for these lakes. He really was an active participant in the discussions. He influenced some of the decision-making that our watershed district board made by participating in those discussions. And he actually became a community leader to really help move forward some of the implementation activities as well. So he was out promoting rain gardens. He was working with the city on stormwater practices. And really, I think getting involved in the monitoring and then carrying that through was something that gave him a lot of tools to be able to have effective interactions at that level, and it was really valuable for local governments also.
Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Lothammer, for the monitoring with the grant program and the impairments, what is the accuracy of those of that monitoring, and what is the quality of that?
Ms. Lothammer.
Mr. Chair and Senator Fredrickson, we work really closely with those local grants in order to ensure that the data that's being collected is very high-quality data. All of the applicants that are collecting data actually need to use certified labs. So they do the SecuDisc monitoring, but then they also take grab samples, which are actually sent to professional labs to do the analysis. And that quality assurance is reviewed as a part of that process to ensure that the data is very high quality and can be used for those assessment purposes.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Lothammer, is that data accepted by EPA when you submit request to EPA?
Mr. Chair and Senator Fredrickson, yes, it is. As long as those quality assurances checks are kind of check out, which is what we do when the data is going into the overall system. But, yes, then it's accepted.
Thank you.
Senator Scogin, and then we should move on to the next report.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Lothammer. In a follow-up to Senator Fredrickson's question, isn't that what hampers citizens at times when they have to take that sample to a location? I think out in my area, we have a lot of lake coalitions that have volunteers that are sampling their lake, but they have a little trouble getting people on board because they have to drive that sample to Fargo, to Detroit Lakes, to Bemidji, to Brainerd, to actually get it sampled. Is the agency doing anything to alleviate some of that?
Sure. Slothammer.
Mr. Chair and Senator Scogin, yes, you're absolutely right that can be a limitation to the local involvement. And that's actually where those surface water assessment grants, I think, can be very helpful, because often what will happen is a local soil and water conservation district or watershed district that does have professional staff will apply for the grants that will give them resources to pay for mileage and things like that, then they can actually pick up the samples and alleviate that from the local volunteer's responsibility and really kind of help with both the efficiency and then meeting what can be a barrier, which you articulated.
So. Thank you. Thank you very much for your presentation. It was very helpful.
Thank you.
The next item on the agenda is a report from the Environmental Quality Board managing for water sustainability. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Princesa Van Buren, and I'm a principal planner with the Environmental Quality Board. My colleague, John Wells, extends his greetings and his apologies that he couldn't be here today. He's out of town, but I welcome the opportunity to talk to you about our report and our findings. And this is my first time testifying before the Senate, so keep me on task and let me know if you have any questions. I also recognize it's been a long afternoon, so I'll try to keep the presentation moving.
I know you have quite a few slides. We should probably end yours by 2:40 so we can leave some room for questions. And so if there are slides that you can kind of glance over quickly, that would be great.
I was hoping for about 15 to 20 minutes. So
great. Perfect.
If things go well, we should be on schedule. Perfect. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
So in a quick overview as to what I'll be talking about today, actually a big thanks to Senator Merriam for laying a lot of the groundwork. The history and some of the needs, plus some of the issues related to water quantity and quality, help lay into the background, the history of the project here. Then I'll discuss the 2008 EQB Water Availability Workgroup process. You guys in your packet should have a copy of that report, along with the presentation from today. I will overview the recommendations of that report, and then I'll just very briefly talk about some of our future activities and how this relates to the EQB 2010 State Water Plan. Just a little history for those, kind of a refresher. The Environmental Quality Board is a board that's composed of 9 state commissioners, along with 5 citizen members and a representative of the governor's office. The mission of the EQB is to develop policy, create long-range plans, and review proposed projects that would significantly influence Minnesota's environment and development. In light of that, we've had a lot of discussion today about some of the challenges that face water management, especially as it relates to water sustainability. The challenge facing managers is that they need to understand how much water do we have, what's available, and how much are we using and how is it allocated. We need to identify who's depending on the water resources, along with the ecosystem services and other natural resource needs that need the water as well. Another challenge is understanding how changes impact the environment and the people as those changes are made. And then we also need to really realize that it's a very complex system. Our water resources don't come down, as we were talking earlier. Through precipitation, you get recharge, but precipitation isn't constant throughout the year. Recharge doesn't occur very well when the ground is frozen. And so our natural ecosystems actually depend on that variability. But between flooding and drought, it makes it harder for people to have a dependable water supply. I have a picture here of the St. Louis River back in 2006. And if you recall, 2006 and 2007 gave Minnesota some challenges with the droughts that we faced across, you know, much of Minnesota. The DNR brought together its drought task force, which actually has been really helping to highlight a lot of these issues for the public. It's been discussed more, and I think people are really starting to understand through education efforts and through some of the challenges what we're facing. And also, leading up to this a little bit, back in 2007, the EQB worked with the DNR on another report. It was the EQB was directed by the governor's office to look at water availability. How much does Minnesota have? How much are we using? What are some of the unknowns in looking at quantity and use? And it was really a finding of this report that recognizing how important water is in planning for growth. And just a really quick summary, what we found in this project is as we look at how much water may be available on a renewable basis, both in the current day and then also extrapolating out 25 years to 2030, what we found is it's possible through our estimates that 7 counties may be using more than half of their renewable resource. In the metropolitan area, the range was 23% to 177%. Greater Minnesota was in a wide range from less than 1% to 81%. As we know, water isn't distributed equally across the landscape, which is why we end up with localized problems and concerns. As we focus on the metro area, this was also referenced by Senator Merriam, we see that looking out to 2030, the rapid growth in Ramsey County and Washington County may mean that they could be estimated to be using more than is annually renewable. And again, 7 counties using more than 50%. So this also, many of the recommendations of this report mirrored where we went with the 2008 work as well. So now looking at the 2008 EQB Water Availability Project, about a year ago, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency Board was struggling with looking at water-using industries in the context of environmental review. As you likely know, they look at environmental review for ethanol plants or for mining industries, some of the high water-using industries. And they're given a lot of really good information about that single permit that they're looking at. But what they're struggling with is how do you put that in the context of other users or future growth? As former Commissioner Moore explained when he brought this before the EQB, he said, the question isn't whether this individual plant has the water it needs. The question is, what does this scenario look like in 25 years? What happens when there's another industry that moves in, when we have some municipal growth, when we add a golf course or two? What does that situation look like? And we don't really have the tools at our disposal right now to answer that. And so February of 2008, the EQB adopted a work plan, and in March, the EQB convened an interagency work group to look at these questions. We also brought in some other technical water experts where needed, and in November 08, we produced the report that you have. The work plan that we were working under had 3 specific charges. So the work group was first to look at achieving protective standards. Minnesota has a very strong water permitting and allocation program. We were challenged to consider what standards, either existing or new, are needed to address environmental impacts of proposed water uses. The second charge went to planning, and we were charged to try to find a way to put these proposed water uses in a context or a perspective so people could understand the significance and its relative impact. And the third charge was looking at data. In order to make good decisions, we really need good information and good data to support those decisions. So we were challenged to summarize the various needs and options for collecting data and how to put that into a comprehensive and timely analysis. The work group was given a couple guidelines. First off, we were given 6 months to produce the report. So that meant we couldn't necessarily design much new. We were also challenged to work with existing data. We weren't given the time or the resources to collect new data. So those are some of the assumptions we worked under. And the outcome we were seeking is that at the end of this, we'd be able to provide the public and state and local government with a better understanding of how decisions today in water permitting and availability will actually impact future conditions. Because what we decide today in terms of policy and planning will impact how things grow, develop, and how that impacts the water resources in the future, how population changes, how the land is developed, and how that relates to water quantity and quality. The work group consisted of a number of state agencies, along with help from federal agencies and the University of Minnesota. We had a really great group with a lot of enthusiasm and a lot of expertise. During the period from March through this fall, we convened 10 meetings of the work group. We also created another technical focus group where we brought in some other private sector individuals, some local government people. We had 3 meetings of the technical group. In total, we had 51 of Minnesota's water experts at the table to give ideas, to offer insight. And each of those members oftentimes went back to their office, their respective groups, and provided input from their staff as well. So the products of this process are really 3. First off, as you know, there's a lot of background information that goes into these things that can't ever make the report. So we have a lot of that supporting background research and information. We worked on developing a prototype information tool, a web-based GIS tool to try to help looking at hypothetical water uses in perspective, and then the final report. And as Senator Miriam mentioned earlier, ethanol production is small in Minnesota. You know, oftentimes the public doesn't understand why we're concerned about it. And you know, look at Minnesota's water use, and we've got ethanol here as being such a small fraction. Or, as Senator Miriam said, we've got 2% going to golf courses, 1% to ethanol. But the problem is that water use is at 15 ethanol plants. So that's 15 locations. We've got more than 15 golf courses in Minnesota. So it goes back to the intensity of use and then the location. So that's some of the background and the history to all of this. In terms of the prototype information tool, I'm just going to touch on it very briefly, but as was discussed earlier this afternoon, we really don't have a good way of putting cumulative potential effects in a context. We can't easily look at the cumulative impacts of water use or future water use. And so the work group convened 2 brainstorming sessions, asking ourselves, if we were to develop some sort of framework or tool to put water use into a broader perspective, what would that entail? What do we need in that tool? And so we put down each of those criteria. Then we looked at some existing tools. There's definitely other web-based, GIS-based tools out there. We looked at some mapping programs of Met Council, along with some other watershed tools of DNR, to try to learn from them pieces that we could put together. It was important as we developed this tool that we allow it to do different scenarios, so that it be user-friendly and that the user could input the various constraints that they desired. It was important that the user be able to select their location of interest and that they be able to put in different hypothetical water uses. And the other thing is, as we look at all of this related to water quantity, we know it's very intricately related to quality, and there's a lot of questions about what climate change will do to recharge and how it may limit future quantity values. And so those are all factors that we integrated into this. So EQB staff worked directly with the Land Management Information Center on developing this. Here's just a quick example, part of Scott County. And so what it means is that a user could look at just some area and not only be interested in quantity, but they could go to that single location. They could say, where are the adjacent wells? From what water level or what aquifer are they drawing from those wells? Where do we have quality concerns? Where are there impaired streams or impaired lakes? Where are the adjacent wetlands and calcareous fens or trout streams that we need to be worried about? So it helps to give the user not just the values of numbers of water use, but also a little bit about the quality of the situation it's in. In terms of output, as the user selects this area that they're interested in, where they want to put down a hypothetical water use, the program then outputs how much is currently being used in the region around that, what's being extrapolated in terms of future use out to 2030, what's the maximum amount of water that the adjacent users are allowed to have through their permit, And so say you're putting in an industry that wants 500 million gallons a year. What is the relative impact of that new use to the existing uses? The system also provides some ideas of an upper threshold of what may be available on a sustainable basis in that area. Provides that relative intensity of use, and then provides a lot of those other qualitative features through data layers. All right, and then to the important part, the report recommendations. We do have 14 recommendations. They're in the report. I very much suggest that you go to them and read them. I tried to highlight some of the key parts of that. If you recall, we have three charges. So looking to the first charge, looking at achieving protective standards. It's important as we move forward, we do have a strong program in place, but that we be able to continue to adapt that program and integrate future water sustainability assessment results into the current regulatory programs. It's also important that as we continue to generate data and generate other information, that we deal with some of the legal and financial security issues that may limit access to the information. And then it's also important as we continue to work with, enhance, and support the existing water quality, quantity, and other networks, that we continue to maintain those and work with those together. In terms of charge two, planning for water sustainability, the planning portion of things, it's important that Minnesotans understand how different incentives for encouraging economic development and so on have a direct impact on water and how things are allocated. We really need to look, as we're doing these economic development opportunities, to seek other concurrent opportunities that support sustainable management. And as we've talked about this afternoon, too, it's very important that we link land use to decision-making, because land use has a direct impact on both water quantity and quality. And it's important that we continue to develop and apply different water sustainability models and planning tools. In Minnesota, there's a number of users that really want to know more about water quantity. Whether it's an industry that's looking to site a new location, they want access to understand, well, where is the water? What is the quality of the water? How much is sustainable? You know, does it work as we're looking to plan something? Local government is looking for information through their planning efforts, state government and others. And so we have various user groups, and each user group oftentimes is asking a different question. So it doesn't always work to develop just a single tool or a single answer, because there's a multitude of questions being asked. It's also important that we continue to try to define what water sustainability limits are. As we've talked about, there's a lot of efforts underway to determine how much water we have in Minnesota, but we don't really know yet, and so we need to continue that. We need to continue to try to determine what may be sustainable. And then when we look at all of this, too, it's important that we don't forget that there are some social and economic factors and not just the environmental data. And the third charge looks at water information needs. And it's important, as we look to try to define how much water is sustainably there, we need to look at the whole hydrologic cycle, whether that's the precipitation that provides the recharge, or whether there's runoff to surface water, whether there's evaporation or transpiration. And so each component of the hydrologic cycle really impacts our understanding of our water supplies. And so it's important that we consider each of the different factors when we do our data collection strategies. And lastly, we need to look, you know, very strongly at data collection. We've done a tremendous job over time. We have so much data in Minnesota. But oftentimes in the past, data has been collected to do problem solving. It's a problem investigation tool where we go in, we know there's a problem, we define the problem, we fix it, and we move on. But oftentimes we don't have a long history of data in really strategic and important places. And so we really need to set some priorities for data collection. We need to set some timelines for getting the information. We need to, of course, identify who's lead on each of these efforts. We need to routinely look at our strategies and appraise them. We need to continue to explore electronic data transfer. As we collect data and invest in data, it's very important that we make it easily accessible to others. We need to set some standards for data collection, and we need to make sure that as we transfer data, it's available to be used in the state geographic information systems. We need to consider how the state, in its collection of data, will provide technical support to local governments or others using the information. And lastly, we need to provide adequate funding for collecting, maintaining data, and then developing applications whereby we can use it. There was a lot more information to this report than we're able to put just either in the report or talk to you about this afternoon. I would welcome, if you have any other questions, to go to our website or to contact us. So where are we going from here? What are we doing with the recommendations? Well, a couple things. The EQB has tasked staff with bringing a work plan to our next meeting in February, looking at the existing recommendations and focusing how, over the next year, we're planning to try to approach a couple of those. And so we're going to reconvene the work group to ask about those efforts. And then in 2010, the EQB has a state water plan. This is a 10-year plan. And what it does is we really look to the past 10 years and how far we've come and the growth that we've done. And then we look to the next 10 years to try to provide a roadmap for where Minnesota needs to be going in some of the priority areas. And there's no doubt that this work and a lot of the other ongoing activities across Minnesota will be a big part of our 2010 state water plan. And with that, I thank you for the opportunity to come here today, and I welcome any questions.
Questions for the witness. We began to hear more from the Environmental Quality Board last session in our confirmation of the citizens, members of the board. And if members recall, we had an extremely enlightening discussion about the current role and activities of the EQB, which are sometimes confusing or even unknown. We learned that, first of all, the Environmental Quality Board, as we saw in one of the first slides, constitutes a broad range of topic areas designated by agency. And so this goes to the previous discussion that was had, and I think it may have even been Senator Anderson's question of Mr. Merriam, what about the coordination of governance? The Environmental Quality Board, in part, goes to that issue. At least there's one place where multiple topic areas are covered in one place regarding at least water. And so I think that I think we're going to hear more and more from the Environmental Quality Board, particularly as the clean water issue becomes more and more prominent, particularly with the Clean Water Fund. What impact the EQB might have on the water portion of the dedicated funding yet to be seen. But I think there will, I think as far as the work of the current work of the EQB goes, I think it's been under-recognized, and that's one of the reasons why we wanted to have them present here today. We wanted to review some current or more recent reports that have been done on water issues for this hearing, and that's the only reason why we didn't hear from specifically from the DNR today. But I did want to see if the DNR had anything they wanted to add to the discussion in our last couple minutes on the water issue, because they do play an important role on water quantity. Welcome to the committee.
Thank
Please
you,
introduce
Chairman.
Yourself.
Committee members, my name is Jim Japs. I'm the Assistant Director for the DNR Division of Waters, and it's
Welcome.
Great to see all the interest on water supply issues, and it really has become much more and more relevant in recent years. As far as some of the things that were said today, there was a discussion about models and, you know, the lack of data that populates those models. And as EQB just mentioned, it's really key that we continue our data gathering to populate those models and get the best data we can to make projections for future and also resource conditions. One of the things that we're going to be doing is looking at that issue of sustainability, looking at developing a priority list for monitoring wells, and also looking at the development of management areas where they're needed and prioritizing some of our work there. And we'll be working with some of the agencies and EQB on those efforts, and also with the Freshwater Society. As EQB mentioned, Minnesota does have a very strong water appropriation permit program. I've been working with the Council of Great Lakes Governors on the Great Lakes Compact now for a number of years, and we clearly have the best program within the Great Lakes Basin. And we're recognized as that, but I think there's always the opportunity to look at ways we can improve that, and that's what we're looking to do at this point.
Does the DNR permit golf courses?
Mr. Chairman, anybody that uses in excess of 10,000 gallons a day or 1 million gallons a year would require a permit from the Department of Natural Resources. If you look at the Great Lakes Compact, the threshold there is 100,000 gallons a day average in a 30-day period would require some sort of regulation. So we go down to a much more refined level.
But if that threshold involved a golf course, the DNR would be involved?
That's absolutely correct.
According to the Internet, Minnesota has between 500 and 600 golf courses. Explore Minnesota reports 500, and golflink.com reports closer to 600. Further questions? Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is the DNR expecting we're going to have the southwestern United States come and try to raid our water and pipe it out of here? I know we've got some protections now with the Great Lakes Compact, but the rest of our water, is that a real issue, and do we need to think about it?
Mr. Jabs.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, under our current law, there is a requirement if you wanted to divert water outside of Minnesota, it would require legislative approval if it exceeded 2 million gallons a day average in a 30-day period. So you certainly would hear about any of those diversion proposals. The one thing about Minnesota's program is you have to be consistent with the Commerce Clause. And we need to treat people from outside the state the same way we treat people within the state as far as our review of applications. And we have a very good program for that. So one of the things we look at is the alternatives and other sources of water that would be available for those sort of purposes.
Thank you, members, for a great hearing, and stay tuned for the agenda for the next meeting. Meeting's adjourned.
Economic development.